From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for you, for every one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Sunday the 15th marks the beginning of the Orthodox Christian Nativity Fast, which continues through Christmas Eve, and next Sunday is the Christian Feast of Christ the King. Ooh, it's been a very busy week at the intersection of religion, government, and politics. A bizarre manufactured social media scandal over Starbucks coffee cups as a proof of a war on Christmas made it onto television news, thanks in part to Donald Trump vaguely expressing possible support for a boycott. Ben Carson spoke at the Conservative Christian Liberty University and said all the right things for anti-gay, anti-science fans. Studies out this week suggest that kids raised without religion grow up to be more selfless as adults, but that religious people are more numerous among military veterans than non-believers. Two men were arrested in Virginia in connection with a plot to bomb black churches and synagogues. And this week's Pinnacle of Hypocrisy Award goes to notorious county clerk Kim Davis's lawyer, Liberty Counsel's Matt Staver, after far-right extremists terrified Texas voters into defeating Houston's human rights ordinance. Staver insisted that the city's mayor needs to embrace the outcome despite well-funded fears of a widespread economic backlash or resign. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
And can you imagine how different our country would be if an additional 70 million evangelical Christians simply showed up and voted biblical values?
Is the deafening volume of culture war rhetoric going to play a role in who turns out to vote next November? A growing number of analysts think it will. We'll get an expert opinion from Dr. Dennis Goldford, who teaches political science at Drake University in Iowa.
A new push to start the day with prayer at public schools.
We have given to the government the role of educating our children.
Zach Coplin is a young Louisiana activist who's done great work in raising awareness of the perils of teaching creationism in science classrooms, going beyond this backdoor injection of religion into public education. Zach has written a compelling piece for Slate magazine headlined Religious Rants in the Classroom, warning that the assault is now at the front door. Zach will be with us later in the hour.
We can't dismiss people out of hand simply because of a mistake that they made in the past.
Earlier this month, President Obama announced sweeping plans to address the challenges faced by formerly incarcerated individuals in reintegrating into society. As welcome as a federal initiative is in addressing this widespread problem, more local attempts at finding solutions can be very instructive in what's going to take to get it right. I'll talk to John Santa, who leads the Malta Criminal Justice Initiative in Connecticut. But first, I can't do anything else until I tell you about my trip to Des Moines, Iowa this past weekend. The purpose of my trip was to meet with the press on Friday evening to talk about religious freedom, to visit with longtime friends at the Interfaith Alliance, Donna Redwing and Connie Ryan Terrell, and then on Saturday morning to deliver a keynote speech on the meaning and importance of, as well as threats to, religious freedom. I traveled to Iowa at the invitation of local activists who were alarmed by what was happening just across town. The extreme right's national gathering called Freedom 2015, an event that had no more to do with freedom, particularly religious freedom, than the National Football League has to do with Russia's Bolshoi Ballet. I was able to keep up on what was going on at that right-wing meeting and was astounded by what I heard coming from the platform. I've spent the better part of my adult life working on promoting, defending, and talking about the importance of religious freedom. In no decade over the past 50 years have I not sounded a warning that religious freedom was in danger. Indeed, I worried about the fact that people might think I had nothing else to say and just delivered the same message every time I spoke. I felt like I could be crying fire so many times that people would quit listening. But I was only telling the truth. I have seen firsthand what happens when religious liberty is denied or replaced by movements that ignore democracy's commitment to assure freedom for minorities as well as for the majority. Such a transition usually occurs by a power grab perpetrated by devotees of raw politics seeking political power and economic gain, or by people faking piety and demonstrating a sick religion in which what they call truth seeks sovereignty to an extent that not even God can stop their onslaught of manipulation and control because they leave the impression that they are God. For most of the decade of the 1970s, I fought hard against a rampant takeover movement by fundamentalists in the Southern Baptist Convention, a denomination that, while I was growing up, taught me the value of religious freedom, demanding that religious institutions never get involved with federal money and praising the Constitution's opposition to a state religion. When an outright political movement in that denomination replaced faith with a sick religion, everything changed for the worst. The convention that praised freedom, as found in the historic Baptist tradition, was stamped out as heresy. That convention began to define itself by authoritarianism and a passion for sovereignty over everybody else. Usually, when sick religion gets sick, it gets really sick, deathly sick, so sick it no longer bears the truths and traits of religion. Science is designated as an enemy. Reason is considered dangerous. And education is replaced by indoctrination in public schools as well as in parochial schools. Assaults on religious freedom are as ugly and untruthful as they are powerful. I know the hurt and the ravages of loss, the loss of a denominational home, the loss of religious freedom. Never, though, never before have I experienced the kind of vicious, mean repugnance related to religious freedom that I witnessed last weekend in Iowa. Every attack on American religious freedom that I have mentioned in recent history was boastfully and repulsively celebrated in that meeting that dared to attach the words religious freedom to its agenda. For over a year, I've been warning people that present attacks on religious freedom are the most dangerous we have seen in a long time, maybe in our lifetime. A combination of bad judgments in the Supreme Court, such as the Hobby Lobby decision, that altered the entire landscape of religious freedom in our nation and produced a proliferation of so-called religious accommodations that actually grant excuses for people to turn their backs on responsible citizenship and protection of religious freedom for everybody else, have merged with the Catholic bishops and some evangelicals to change the definition of religious freedom so radically that they can advocate contradictions to religious freedom as the real thing. Nowhere has that strategy and its dangers been dramatized more clearly than it was last weekend in Iowa? Freedom 2015 was organized and hosted by Reverend Vincent Swanson. Clearly, a prime motivator for bringing 1,700 people from all across America to rant and rave in Iowa was the Supreme Court's ruling on marriage equality. Indeed, Pastor Swanson raged against homosexuals and reminded the audience that what he called God's word demanded, get this, friends, demanded capital punishment for all homosexuals. Now, later he qualified that generalization and said that capital punishment should apply only to, quote unquote, practicing homosexuals, not to those who refuse to act on their identity. Friends, I heard that. I heard it. I got sick as I listened to his screaming about killing homosexuals, meaning our LGBT friends, neighbors, co-workers, and children. The kind of religious freedom that this man and his colleagues support is not about every individual in the nation having religious freedom. Indeed, when talking about the supposedly wrong sexual orientation, the protection of religious freedom requires defending the use of capital punishment for LGBT persons. How in the world can that be called religious freedom? And how in this world or any other is Swanson saying that his God permits throwing people to their deaths from the tops of buildings as punishment for the wrong kind of sex any different from what the ISIS terrorists are already doing? Look, I know sick religion when I see it or when I hear it. It's dangerous. Sick religionists are capable of doing or saying in God's name words and actions that are blasphemous in real religion and dangerous to the goodness and welfare of a state. Friends, it's bad enough when a fringe so-called ministry like the Westboro Baptist Church preaches hate in the name of faith. But last weekend in Iowa was no fringe event. Present in that audience and even allowing the sponsor of this event, the gay hater who talked about being a gay killer, to interview them, to test their moral strength in his ministry of hate, where three presidential candidates who with their presence supported the conference and worse still, its message. Bobby Jindal, Ted Cruz, and Mike Huckabee gave credibility to the incredible celebration of hate and threat of actual death to LGBT Americans. How dare they? How could they want to be president of the United States when the Constitution they would swear to uphold is in absolute opposition to the agenda they helped to heighten and celebrate in Iowa? Not even running for the presidency in the sad Anything Goes 2016 campaign justifies candidates showing up and legitimizing a meeting like that. Ted Cruz, during his on-stage interview with the sponsor of the event, said that a prerequisite for the presidency is to start each day on one's knees praying to God. Take note of this prerequisite for the presidency embraced in his understanding of religious freedom. There was no question for Cruz or the other presidential candidates about whether or not they would reach out to Americans of all religions and no religion when they put together their cabinet and staff if they won. There was no question about whether the president would grant the same rights, freedoms, and provisions for all Americans or for only Christians in agreement with their belief. The implication portrayed on that stage was that whichever of these three candidates for the presidency won the election would turn the Oval Office into the headquarters for a movement to get rid of religious freedom. Please understand my message. A movement is underway to redefine religious freedom to such an extent that this historic term can now be used to support everything that contradicts religious freedom. And the very real danger of that movement is its clear ability to hijack the American political process in the service of its goals. Now, back to my visit in Iowa last weekend. Mine was the privilege of speaking to well over 100 people about what's happening in the crusade to steal the language of religious freedom in order to change the meaning of religious freedom. Members of both houses of the state legislature of Iowa were present to share their fears of the loss of this precious treasure in their state. School teachers and officials spoke of the challenges they face in being able to offer students a real education, not one approved by popular pastors with a death wish for all who oppose their no-holds-barred destruction of the Constitution. All of us in that room were aware that in Des Moines on that Saturday morning, the 100 of us were up against 1,700 on the other side of the city and on the other side of truth. But this is not a matter of numbers. It's a matter of the legacy of our founders and of the liberty that we want now for ourselves and in our future for our grandchildren. I said to the people in that room that with a passion similar to that with which I spoke to them, I will defend the rights of those people in that garish meeting across town to speak in freedom. But never, never will I do anything but oppose with every fiber of my being people who associate religious freedom with threats of treating any group of people with capital punishment because they don't conform to a particular religion or choose not to be a religious person at all. Friends, this has to stop now. Read the First Amendment again. One person's religious freedom stops at the point that individual's behavior compromises, violates, or erases any other person's religious freedom. We're dealing with a sick religion and a level of right-wing advocacy for eradicating religious freedom like we have seldom seen in this nation. I saw it. I saw it with all of its ugliness and hatred in Iowa. But unfortunately, the problem is not just in Iowa. It's all across our nation. And it is attracting politicians who, if elected to office, would have to cross their fingers behind their backs to take the oath of office that requires them to pledge to defend the Constitution. When the Constitutional Convention wrapped up its important work, Ben Franklin was heard saying, "You have a republic if you can keep it." Friends, we have to keep it for the good of all people and for the good, the preservation and promise of our nation. We've seen sweeping changes in the American cultural landscape in recent years, progress that many liberals have celebrated, even as some conservatives have all but declared the end of our nation. How might that impact next year's elections, separate from any other issues in play? Dr. Dennis Goldford is professor of political science at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. Dr. Goldford, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You were quoted in a recent CNN piece titled "Fear and Voting on the Christian Right." Specifically, self-protection was identified as a voter motivator. Would you expand on that, please?
A lot of people don't vote, as we know. In fact, for all the hullabaloo about the Iowa caucuses and the primary process for presidential nominations, on average, only where somewhere between 17 and 20% of eligible people actually turn out. But this isn't the same across all groups. And people often vote for positive reasons. You really like somebody's message, for example. But people also vote for negative reasons, in that they are concerned about some major issue of personal importance to them, or in their view, important to the nation. And they vote out of that concern that sometimes becomes fear that something they value is slipping away.
Mm-hmm.
Fear becomes a very important motivator.
Do you think that some progressives are failing to realize how deep the fear of the rapid change we've been seeing is among many conservatives?
I think so. You know, one of the main characteristics of the difference between the parties over the past, oh, I would say 30, 40 years, is the opening of the gender gap, whereby women tend to be more likely to vote Democratic and consider themselves liberal, and men tend to be more conservative and vote Republican. That's not all, of course, on either mm-hmm. side. But I think one of the main reasons that progressives, as you put it, have not noticed is that really since the late 1960s or so, Democrats and liberals have become known, whether they intended it or not, as advocates for women and minorities, and especially among white males. My sense is that for a lot of white, especially working class males, when they look at liberals and Democrats, their view is you took our jobs, or you represent the people that have taken our jobs, women and minorities. And so there's that tremendous fear of social decline and decline in one's circumstances.
Are there any signs that you're seeing this play out already on the ground in Iowa, even this early in the process?
I've attended a lot of, as part of covering the caucuses, a lot of events held by both parties. And I've found, generally speaking, that at Democratic events, the people that show up are relatively happy, optimistic people.
Mm-hmm.
And the candidates tend to play up their sense of goals for the future. On the Republican side, I've had a sense among a lot of people that there's a lot more fear and anger. You know, that sense of we've got to take our government back. We have to take our country back. That sense of fear that was illustrated really even during the early days of the Obama administration. I remember an elderly white woman at a town hall meeting that was on television, and she was quaking with fear when she went to the microphone saying, "I want my country back." And you have particular candidates on the Republican side that really play on that. Look at some of the speeches and ads by Bobby Jindal, for example, where at a defining moment where we're going to lose the American dream, we're going to lose the American idea, the very idea of American. And so there's an attempt to exploit fears, usually on both sides, but I particularly see it on the Republican side, that something of fundamental importance and value is changing or leaving us in America, and their concern is to reclaim it.
There's no question about the real discomfort that we see as a result of this, and I think it's obvious that there are a number of religious right figures who have become experts in knowing how to touch that fear factor. How powerful are organized efforts to relentlessly portray these changes as nothing less than the end of life as we know it?
It's a strong narrative. It's a very strong narrative. I think you have quite a number of candidates and their operatives emphasizing that sense of fear, because what's important, you know, the old line in terms of real estate is the three most important factors are location, location, and location.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in electoral politics, the three most important factors are turnout, turnout, and turnout.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever public opinion in the country at large might be, what matters is who actually shows up to vote. So you see Ted Cruz, for example, arguing about how we're on the precipice. He says this is the most important election since 1980. And his main focus, illustrated by the fact he declared his candidacy at Liberty University, is to say that there are millions of evangelicals who have not turned out to vote. And if only they will turn out, then you don't have to worry about compromising with anybody else. Cruz and his particular program, if elected with the support of these sleeping evangelicals who, in his view, don't vote, they will be able to turn the country around by imposing their particular policies.
I'm interested in what you've seen in the political season so far this year in Iowa. How would you compare what's happening this time around with what you've seen happen in other years past?
There is more of that edge, more of that sense of danger on the part of people involved in politics, danger if the other side wins. Again, it's less pronounced on the Democratic side, more pronounced among various candidates and their supporters on the Republican side. And again, that's not meant as a partisan statement at all. It's meant simply in an observational sense. If you look at television advertising, there's not a great deal of it yet here in Iowa, but you see ads from Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and you see ads from Bobby Jindal and from Ben Carson. Ted Cruz is about to go up with some ads. So far, that's all we've seen. That will simply intensify as we get closer to the caucuses February 1st. There's a somewhat of an edge of concern in these ads, but at least at that level, it's not overwhelming yet. But it's at the actual candidate forum where they're particularly focused on questions of faith and freedom and the focus on what's considered to be religious liberty. You see more of a concern there. It's still fairly measured, at least what I've seen so far here in Iowa. That may get worse as time proceeds, but there's no guarantee of that.
Professor Dennis Goldford teaches in the areas of political theory and constitutional law at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. Dr. Goldford, thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio. And I want to tell you, very likely, we're going to be back in touch with you to talk some more about not only what's going on in Iowa, but what's going on all across the United States.
No, it would be my pleasure. Always glad to talk to you.
Although State of Belief listeners first met Zach Coplin as a high school student fighting to keep creationist teachings out of public school classrooms in Louisiana, over the years, Zach has grown into an effective voice for a broader set of important education issues in his home state and beyond. When his recent article for Slate magazine headlined "Religious Rants in the Classroom" got forwarded by a concerned parent, I knew it was past time to have Zach back on the show. Zach, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Students in public schools say Christianity is being forced on them. How bad is it?
It's absolutely unbelievable. We have creationism being taught. We have students being forced to attend club meetings by their teachers, by the principal for the Fellowship of Christian Athletes during school hours. We're having assemblies where they bring in the founder of the local gym, it's called the Christ Fit Gym, to preach to students about how he overcame PTSD through his faith in Jesus. Now, that's wonderful. I'm thrilled they overcame PTSD, an awful thing. Still really not appropriate for public schools. There are even reports of Bibles being thrown at students in 2011 where the Fellowship of Christian Athletes was handing out Bibles, and students who refused to accept them had them thrown at their heads. And then the principal announced that he had no complaints, nothing had happened, so he refused to take action. And in reality, he's been explicitly supporting promotion of religion in the schools for as long as he's been principal, and preaching over the intercom. I mean, I had a number of students tell me that he uses his position of authority to proselytize and convert students to Christianity.
Zach, how did you get in touch with these students?
So I've been working on Bossier Parish Schools and specifically Airline High School for about 6 to 8 months now, where I had done a sort of routine public records request that I was doing to almost all the school districts in the state. But when it came back from Bossier, I found emails from science teachers that explained they used the Book of Genesis as a supplemental material to debunk evolution and had students present alternatives to evolution along with reading the Book of Genesis in the science class. And that pretty quickly put the school district on my radar because they were using what's called the Louisiana Science Education Act to teach creationism. It's a law that allows, again, you to use supplementary materials to critique evolution. And that's exactly what they were doing with the Book of Genesis. So I'd already written a huge piece on Airline High School when the ACLU got involved and sent a warning letter to Airline over other complaints, including the principal praying over the intercom. when that happened, I reached out to students over social media. And so I met with a bunch of students in Bossier, and they told me all about what was happening in their school.
I think the most disturbing part of the article for me are some of the community responses that came after the ACLU stepped in. Tell us as much as you can about those responses.
Well, this is a fascinating example for me of like this utter disconnect between the evangelical persecution complex, as it's often called, and what was actually happening in reality, where the community as a whole felt legitimately persecuted, that they were under attack by the ACLU for what was really a simple letter saying, this is illegal, please stop doing this. It wasn't a threat. It wasn't saying, we were going to make sure you'll be fired. It wasn't a, you're in trouble. It was a, you can't do this, please don't do this. It was pretty kind. But they worked themselves up, and every person who talked about it more got madder and madder. And you have Fox News involved, and you have local preachers from all over North Louisiana driving to town to protest. And you have maybe 1,000 people show up out front of the school to hold a prayer rally where they're talking about spiritual warfare, but all this conversation is about warfare, it's about fighting, and you have anonymous comments talking about how the person who complained to the ACLU would be dragged across the parking lot behind a truck, was what one of the kids mentioned to me. And so there's this huge disconnect between the kids who I talk to who are legitimately afraid that they can't use their real names. They're afraid that their friends will be able to figure out, which is still being called being persecuted. And that it's a huge disconnect to me. It's fascinating.
Sure. As bad as they are, these stories are just a snapshot. We had a mother forward your article with the comment that her son faced this same kind of pressure in Queens, New York. And that when she tried to complain, she was told it would make life tough for her son if she didn't drop the matter. Zach, what is a parent to do?
If the parent is really brave, then they can sue. You do go through a process. You complain to the principal. If the principal doesn't work, you complain to the school district. And if that doesn't work either, that's when you sue. But, again, that is a really incredibly scary process. You could be chased out of your community, basically. And I think if someone sued in Bossier, they would be chased out.
Yeah.
That's the impression I get. You have to be willing to take a stand and deal with the consequences that could be completely life-changing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, and I hate saying this, otherwise, it's better to keep silent than get attacked. It's something I hate saying because I don't think we can be silent about this. But sometimes, if you have a sixth grader in the school, and you can inoculate them yourselves from, like, you can take them home and say, when they get taught creationism, this is not science, I'd say don't get yourself killed.
Oh, my. Are there local resources that concerned people can turn to, or is it all up to the ACLU and national groups like Americans United, the Freedom from Religion Foundation?
So it's actually what's interesting is the key piece here is the local, or not local groups, it's the locals. Because the ACLU can provide lawyers, they can provide money. They don't actually have the ability to take on a case themselves. They need someone from the community to come out and say, we are willing to sue this. And that's why this is such a challenging issue, because you have, again, families are afraid to take that role and be the sort of the actual person on the ground. Right now we have national, because again, the ACLU is not afraid of the boat of Bossier. Like they're not, you can't, it's an organization. It's not in danger. And they're happy to provide all the legal support, all the money they need. It's just, they also need, they need someone who's willing to be brave and stand up there. And there aren't really any local groups specifically. You have groups statewide, like the Louisiana Coalition for Science, which work on these issues. But none of them have money like the ACLU does.
Do you have any estimate of how many schools actually would fall into the category of classroom activities that we're talking about right now? I want people to understand we're not talking about a school here and there.
Yeah. It's actually easier to explain this nationally because the issue isn't, like, at Airline High School, which I just wrote about, it's a school problem, it looks like. But for the most part, this is a teacher-by-teacher problem, and it's actually a problem nationwide, mm-hmm. where there have been surveys done of public school biology teachers that show about 13 to 15% of biology teachers are teaching creationism outright in public schools. And this is, like you mentioned, there's problems in New York. This is just like that. There's problems in New York. There's problems in Texas. There's problems in California. It's all over the country, mm-hmm. and it's urban and rural. So 15% biology teachers are teaching creationism, and another 60%, which, and this may even be more concerning, another 60% aren't teaching evolution, either because they don't believe it, they're not qualified, they don't understand it. Hmm. So that leaves only a little bit more than 25% of American students who are getting the biology education they need to succeed.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly severe problem in America.
I know as people listen, they want to know how they can stay in touch with what you're doing and follow your work. Tell them about your website so they will have access to your wisdom.
So the best way to actually follow me is on Facebook. Just follow Zach Coplin. And the best thing anyone can do to get involved is call their local school board, call their legislators and tell them not to support creationism in schools. Or if you're in Bossier, Louisiana, and you have a kid in public school and you're ready to take the fight to the Bossier school board over this specific issue, call the ACLU, because I'm sure they'd be willing to help you.
Zach, I want to ask you one question. It's certainly related to everything we're talking about, but it's even broader than that and more personal. You have laid your integrity on the line. You've submitted yourself to criticism. It's not been an easy road. I'm curious as to what motivated you, even at an early age, to get into this fight and then be so sustained and dogged in keeping with the fine work that you do. What motivated that?
So at the beginning, because we've talked briefly about the Louisiana Science Education Act, we had this creationism law. And I just, like, as a kid, I knew it was wrong. And it was sort of naive. I just didn't understand why people supported it, why people were behind something that was so clearly wrong. And it was simply right and wrong for me. And it marinated my brain for a couple years. The law passed when I was 14, and I just was waiting. I knew that it was wrong. I was waiting for someone to fix it because it was wrong, and that was the only calculation in my mind. And after about 3 years, I realized, like, no one's doing anything about this thing that's so blatantly wrong, and there's plenty of issues that are also that simply right and wrong, but this was the one that stuck in my mind at the right age.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally, I just said, well, it's wrong. I'm going to try and fix it, and that was all I chose. And then, I mean, staying in this, it's what I love doing, and I think it's a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think, and there's always going to be more to do on separation of church and state. So I'm not sure. If I'm ever going to be able to stop doing the work I do.
Zach Coplin began the campaign to repeal the Louisiana Science Education Act, Louisiana's creationism law. While still in high school, he has expanded his activism to fighting for science funding and against science denial in all forms. Zach, as always, what you say is so insightful. You're always welcome, buddy, on State of Belief Radio. I want you to keep up the good work, and we still want to stay in touch.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's always a blast.
Earlier this month, President Obama announced a number of plans to make the reintegration process less impossible for Americans who have served time behind bars. Remarkable work on this issue at the state level has been going on for years, specifically in Connecticut, where the Malta Criminal Justice Initiative has taken the lead for concrete reform. Joining me now is John Santa, Chair of the Malta Criminal Justice Initiative. John, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much, Bob. Nice to be with you.
Let's start with a little background on the Order of Malta's involvement in prison issues. I know you can fill us in.
Certainly will. Thanks very much. The Order of Malta, first of all, is the third oldest order in the Roman Church. Started in the late 11th century. We see are men and women who do work on behalf of the sick and the poor all around the world. 13,000 of us around the world, around 3,000 in America. Back in the late 1990s, I had a situation where I went to visit a friend who went to prison. And it so happened that I was in formation for the order at that point in time. And when I went into prison, with the words, serving the sick and the poor, echoing in my mind, I looked around the prison population. And my goodness, our proudest product in prison is poverty. We make poverty there. Mm. If people aren't poor coming in, they'll be poor coming out. So therefore, there were poor people aplenty. And additionally, 9 in 10 people that find their way into our criminal justice system are mentally ill and or addicted. So it was a mission that fit very well for the Order of Malta.
Is there a religious component to your approach to criminal justice?
Well, certainly there is a religious component in that we are informed and inspired by our Christian faith, our Catholic religion. Mm-hmm. But I would say to you that while we do some sacramental preparation work in prison and the like, we are more here to serve the people who are incarcerated of any faith tradition. Mm-hmm. And we welcome people of any faith tradition to our mission because we do what we do because we are Christians and Catholics, not because they are Christians and Catholics. Mm. We're not strictly proselytizing.
I understand, and I'm glad. John, I think it would be really helpful for you to talk about the specific issues that face Americans after a sentence behind bars.
Yes, well, there's prison ministry work to be done behind bars and in correctional institutions. Much, much more of it is to be done in the free world because there are so many people coming out of prison every year. Mm-hmm. Now, their plight once out is daunting. At the very least, it's daunting. There was a report released by the American Bar Association mm-hmm. a couple of months back indicating that according to their research, there are 50,000 laws, rules, and regulations against people coming out of prison getting a job, living in this, certain accommodations, being able to vote, being able to get certain licenses. It's a myriad of things thwart people as they try to come out and they try to regain their life. And, you know, as if things weren't hard enough already, right now in the Order of Malta here in Connecticut, we're about to begin a survey. We're going to do a top-flight survey of employer opinion on the hiring of formerly incarcerated people. We know that there is a bias against hiring them, but we want to find out what that bias is all about. And we want to find the dimensions of that and see if we can somehow deal with that. Because I think that a lot of people have an attitude, a negative attitude towards formerly incarcerated people when they don't even think about it. Mm-hmm. They don't even realize that these are human beings. These are people. These are, we Christians call them children of God, just like us. Mm-hmm. They're human beings. And granted, they failed in some way to society, but that doesn't mean they're not any good.
How did you address these challenges in Connecticut?
Well, you know, it's funny. Well, in our raging naivete, we first went to employers. And the employers that we found were community groups like Rotary, Kiwanis, and Lions Club, and churches and business groups. And we went out and we made over 45 presentations to groups like that all across the state of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And we struck out. We got no jobs. Nobody stood up and said, let's hire somebody. This is a great idea. But what we found out was we plumbed the depths of the ignorance of the average walking around person as regards the criminal justice system in America. They had no idea. They had no idea that we incarcerated 25% of the world's prisoners with 5% of the world's population. They had no idea how out of step we were with 36 Western nations. Our incarceration rate is 9 times that of Germany's. And Germany's not the Wild West. Mm. They had no idea the outrageous cost that it was to incarcerate people, nor did they have any idea as to the overwhelming failure rate and the recidivism that 2 in 3 formerly incarcerated people were back in prison within 3 years. Hmm. Now, when they found that out, people were not happy. They were not pleased with that, and they shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't be, right?
Right.
I'm not. So what we did was we changed our focus to become advocates and to work on advocacy. And to that end, we wrote our book called The Justice Imperative, which is, best of our knowledge, a never-before-done book. It was a book on criminal justice reform in Connecticut, but it could well be adapted to Iowa or Georgia or Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, we used our book to go and speak to three specific audiences, and they were the faith communities, the academic communities, and the business communities of the state of Connecticut. And our idea was to bring this book to them, to educate and inform them, to help them to find their voice, so that they would speak to legislators about making changes in criminal justice policy, practice, and budgeting that would make this a better situation, much better than it is. And we chose those three for two specific reasons. Number one, they are thought leaders. By their very nature, they are thought leaders to the general public. Secondly, all three of them are halfway home on this deal. Hmm. Business people know that the amount of money we're spending on incarceration and the failure rate thereof is very imprudent mm-hmm. and very wasteful of tax dollars. Academic people, they're the people that study and do background information and find out why things are as they are and do research. Well, I mean, if you can add two and two, you know this system is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, as regards faith people, well, as you may or may not realize, the system we have in America and the prisons we've built and the system we run here is built on the concept that people that go to prison are irredeemable. They're beyond redemption.
Hmm.
And I don't know about you, but we don't believe that. That is antithetical mm-hmm. to everything we do as Christians and Catholics. We believe in redemption. Therefore, those faith communities, and I mentioned the Christian one, but my goodness, Muslim, Jew, Baha'i, everybody mm-hmm. knows that people are redeemable for sure, for sure, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had some considerable success with that.
Well, John, you've got a grasp on how to address this locally. You've proven that where you live. When we think about it nationally, what is most needed to begin bringing concrete reforms at the national level?
I think that it is very important that we shift the paradigm of public opinion. Now, let's think about this. How did we get to where we are? We had a lot of civil unrest in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. You know, cities being burned down, the civil rights movement, anti-war protests, the murders of the two Kennedy brothers and King and Watergate, and you know, there's a lot of lawlessness going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, therefore, the American public was very ready to receive a message of law and order, lock them up and throw away the key, we're going to make our streets safe for your women and children, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that came such things as the Rockefeller drug laws and three strikes and you're out, and 10 times the penalty for crack cocaine is powdered cocaine, and all manner of draconian sanctions and measures mm-hmm. that were going to make our streets safe. Who doesn't remember the famous Willie Horton incident
sure.
with regard to Michael Dukakis
mm-hmm.
when he was running against Bush for president? They made that a cause celeb, that Dukakis was, quote, soft on crime, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And that became the worst thing any politician could be. Conversely, if you're tough on crime, that was very, very good. Well, understand that we Americans, we regular voting citizens, we regular people, we bought that hook, line, and sinker.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, between 1980 and 2000, our prison population quadrupled.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it might surprise you and your listeners to understand that in the decade of the 1990s, we were finishing, here in America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, we were finishing a new prison every 2 weeks.
Mm.
Every 2 weeks. We built 240 new prisons in America in that one decade. That was the power of public opinion. That was the power of the political advancement of a concept. And so, to me, it makes a lot of sense that if that's how we got in here, that's how we ought to get out of here, too. And that it would be prudent of us to try to shape and change public opinion about this. And we're working on that. That's what our book, The Justice Imperative, is about. That's what other people are trying to do. And so, therefore, if Obama stands up on this, that's good. That's very good.
And, John, tell our listeners, before we get off, how they can keep up with your work.
Absolutely. They're welcome to go to our website, MaltaJusticeInitiative.org. MaltaJusticeInitiative.org. There's some great resources there. The second thing they could do is they could visit the website of our book, and that's thejusticeimperative.org. And then our book is available on Amazon.com in either hard copy or Kindle version.
John Santa is chair of the Malta Criminal Justice Initiative. After a lifetime in business, John has devoted himself to working to inform and educate the business, faith, and academic communities about the opportunities available in criminal justice legislative reform. John, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio. Keep us informed.
Thank you very much, Walton. I really appreciate having been with you, and God bless you and the work you're doing too, my friend.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We rely on listener support to keep this show on the air. As the end of the year gets closer, please consider a tax-deductible contribution to State of Belief and to Interfaith Alliance. You don't have any idea how much that will help. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to friends or acquaintances, please share it with them. It's very easy to do on Facebook, Twitter, and at stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you'll find extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. You never know what's happening there. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.